Is that it? Oh, there we go. What a way to start. Well, good morning. Yes. Oh, you talk back. That's so good. Our early service never talked back to me, and I had to ask, like, good morning three times. It is my privilege to be with you this morning. I have known about you in this community from afar and heard about the good work that you're doing, and so I'm so honored to be with Josh and his family and all of you today. We're continuing your series this morning, 10 Words, it is called, and we're looking at the commandment, thou shalt not murder. Question first, when was the last time, if ever, you have heard a sermon completely dedicated to this commandment? Anybody? No. Yes. So I, in my 36 years, I've never heard one, nor have I ever written one. And I immediately, a couple of weeks ago, asked Stan Mitchell, my counterpart in ministry, and he told me that in over 7,000 messages and lessons, he has never heard one, not for the first time, devoted an entire message to this commandment forbidding murder. And I think we understand why, right? You don't suspect that in a crowd on Sunday morning of churchgoers that there are too many folk contemplating this heinous crime. There are some sins that are so radically extreme that as a pastor you think, well, this one is obviously off limits and I surely don't need to address it, right? And frankly, you may be thinking, really? I'm about to sit through an entire sermon on this. Well, I can sympathize for sure, as I felt a bit of the same unbelief when shortly after I had the pleasure of being invited to be with you. I was given the topic at hand by your pastor and encouraged to spend my first time as a guest speaker at this wonderful place addressing this less than exciting topic. Thank you, Pastor Josh.
That was intentional.
I see. He just gave me the hard one, right? So for the past several weeks in preparation for this morning, I've been mulling over this sixth commandment of the Decalogue, contemplating its place in society, in my own heart, and of course in the narrative of the Judeo-Christian Bible. The more I gave myself, admittedly, to this subject, I realized that there is something very significant here for us to consider. Societally, sociologically, or interpersonally, no crime or act of immorality ranks higher than murder. Arguably, there is nothing that you can do or have done to you worse than to take the life of a human being or to have your life taken by the hand of another. As a human society, we even reserve our severest forms of punishment for those who commit this evil act of selfishly choosing to make the decision to snuff out the gift of life belonging to another person. And though I would rather not admit it, in my own heart, while I have never even remotely considered committing murder, I have battled unforgiveness. I have wrestled with bitterness. I have struggled with the hatred of some people. In my life, have not escaped unscathed from the brokenness that can develop within our human relationships. And while I've never come close to the devastating sin of murder, I have felt the desire for someone else to suffer. I have. And knowing that it was not my place or my capacity to do that, I have tried a time or two to hire God as my hitman, employing prayer to communicate the request and believing that if God did it for me, then somehow that would sanitize the crime. And thankfully, God has never accepted the contracts that I proposed in my weaker moments. But before we get to the actual commandment that does apply to us more than we realize, let's begin with how we simply think about actual murderers, those who have committed these heinous crimes and obviously have broken this commandment. I want us to push past what some of us carry as prejudices towards who we deem as evil people. And I should confess to you up front that along with my friend Ron Miller, who also works back at Grace Point as an administrator, we lead a ministry to the incarcerated called Timothy's Gift. Over the past 3 years, I have ministered now to thousands of women and men, hundreds of whom have committed this despicable act of murder. And my heart has been confronted and undeniably altered in many ways. Not the least of these alterations has been in the area of judgment and of spiritual arrogance. Sadly, one of the ways that we satisfy our own insecurities regarding our worth is to employ the ineffectual and highly distasteful method of being smugly self-righteous. We think that we know that we are the good ones and they are the bad ones. We do that often. See, the first time I went to prison, I went in and I expected to feel that disgust or that anger towards these people. Or really, I expected to not feel anything at all except good of myself for being there and choosing to go do this ministry. But when I got there, I realized that wasn't what I found at all. I looked into the eyes of these men and women, and I did not see a murderer. I did not see a rapist or a thief. I looked into their eyes, and I saw the eyes of a child. I believe I got to see a glimpse of how God sees us as the beloved and as humans, simply humans, broken humans, yes. Ones who had committed and brought about hell to this earth, yes. But I did not want to move away from them. I did not want to turn away. I didn't want to push them away. Somehow, like a mother to a child, I wanted to pull them in a little bit closer and say, maybe you've forgotten who you are. Or maybe no one ever told you that you are the beloved child of God, meant to thrive in this world. That same experience in prison happened when we brought one of our congregants, a woman whose brother had been murdered, and she chose to go with us on one of these trips to prison. And after we got back from the trip, she emailed me and she said, "This month marks 7 years since my brother was murdered." She said, "I've struggled with knowing I need to forgive and being able to actually say the words and mean them." She said, "When I went behind those bars and I spent those 2 hours with the men, I felt like I was looking into the eyes of a dragon to find there was no fire and no need to slay him." She said, "There was less of a demon and more of a fallen human than I had pictured in my mind. I felt more compassion than I expected to and more courage to follow through with what my heart had been convicted to do, to forgive this man." I watched a similar story play out on a documentary on TV recently. It was about 17 years after the Holocaust, and they were bringing in a witness to one of the men who was a major player in one of the death camps. The scene captured when the witness was finally able to see the accused man, the guilty man who had committed the murders of so many people, including this man's mother, brothers, and sisters. And 17 years later, when he was finally able to confront this man in the courtroom, he didn't lash out. He fell to his knees weeping. They ended up closing the courtroom, and later in an interview they asked him, and he said, "You know, all these years, all this hatred, all this bitterness that is built up, and I expected to see a monster in that man, but instead I saw myself." He said, "I looked at him and I saw just a little shoe cobbler with his wife and his family and his grandkids sitting behind him." And he said he realized in that moment that any human, any one of us has the capacity to do the most dastardly things. It's in these settings, for me in prison and for in the courtroom for this man, that all of a sudden the dreaded they become us. They become us. Let's look at the story, if we will, this morning in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. If you brought your Bibles or have your smartphones this morning, you can pull it up. I'm reading from the Contemporary English Version. So Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. Jesus told this parable to certain people who had convinced themselves that they were righteous and who looked on everyone else with disgust. Two people went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other was a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed about himself with these words, "God, I thank you that I am not like everyone else, crooks, evildoers, or adulterers. Even like this tax collector." He goes on to say, "I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of everything I receive." But the tax collector stood at a distance, it says. He wouldn't even lift his eyes to look toward heaven. Rather, he struck his chest and said, "God, show mercy to me, a sinner." "I tell you," Jesus says, this person, the tax collector, went down to his home justified rather than the Pharisee. All who lift themselves up will be brought low, and those who make themselves low will be lifted up. So yes, thou shall not kill. But let us also not be quick to judge or think of ourselves too righteous, because our place is not the judgment seat. That is for God's. Our place is at the table, welcoming all, just as Jesus did. Another story in Matthew 5, Jesus steps in and he brings us back to level ground, which is what he is so good at. He helps us move from the unhealthy perspective like that of the Pharisee and brings us to the enlightened position of the tax collector. Jesus said some things in the famed Sermon on the Mount that are germane to our discussion this morning. So let's look at Eugene Peterson's take on Matthew 5, 17 through 22, in his translation, paraphrase the Message. Verse 17, "Don't suppose for a moment that I have come to demolish the scriptures, either God's law or the prophets. I'm not here to demolish, but to complete. I'm going to put it all together, pull it all together in a vast panorama. God's law is more real and lasting than the stars in the sky and the ground at your feet. Long after stars burn out and earth wears out, God's law will be alive and working. Trivialize even the smallest item in God's law, and you will only have trivialized yourself, but take it seriously. Show the way for others, and you will find honor in the kingdom. Unless you do far better than the Pharisees in the matters of right living, you won't know the first thing about entering the kingdom." He goes on to say, "You're familiar with the commands to the ancients, do not murder. And I'm telling you that anyone who is so much as angry with a brother or sister is guilty of murder. Carelessly call a brother an idiot and you just might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister and you are on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill." The simple moral fact is that words kill. See, we are familiar with thou shall not murder and what that meant. But now Jesus comes and shows us how it becomes way more than just causing a physical, biological death. Our words and our actions can cause the deterioration of the human soul. Our words and our actions can cause the deterioration of the human soul. Jesus is clarifying that we have the ability to either aid in human flourishing or to aid in the lessening of the life of an individual. So we can either be contributing to someone and adding to their life, or we can be sucking the life from them. We can be these psychological parasites or fleas or leeches, killing slowly maybe without even realizing it. Proverbs 18:21 says, "Words kill, words give life. They're either poison or they're fruit. You choose. You choose." So we can choose then to be a blessing in this life, which is what we are created to do, or we can choose to be a curse. We can choose to cause ill will, to hate, to hurt, to slowly murder those who we come in contact with. And that sounds really extreme to call it murder. And yet Jesus says this is the power that we hold, not only in our actions, but in our tongue. And look at James 3:3-12. "A bit in the mouth of a horse controls the whole horse. A small rudder on a huge ship in the hands of a skilled captain sets a course in the face of the strongest winds. A word out of your mouth may seem of no account, but it can accomplish nearly anything or destroy it." Verse 5, "It only takes a spark, remember, to set off a forest fire. A careless or wrongly placed word out of your mouth can do that. By our speech, we can ruin the world. We can turn harmony into chaos. We can throw mud on a reputation. We can send the whole world up in smoke and go up in smoke with it, smoke right from the pit of hell. And this is scary. You can tame a tiger, but you can't tame a tongue. It's never been done. The tongue runs wild, a wanton killer. With our tongues, we bless God. And with the same tongues, we curse the very men and women made in his image. Curses and blessings out of the same mouth." And then it goes on to say in verse 18, "You can develop a healthy, robust community that lives right with God, enjoys its results, only if you do the hard work of getting along with each other and treating each other with dignity and honor." See, to be in this world is in fact to belong to each other, to recognize that we are the beloved. We have inherent worth as bearers of the image of our God, but so do they. Whoever your they is, your family, your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your enemies, they are all the beloved. They all deserve to be treated with dignity and with respect. I think that's the beauty and uniqueness of the prison ministry that I'm involved in. We aren't going behind those bars to remind these men and women of how bad they are or how bad of the choices that they've made. We're going in to remind them who they are at their core, the beloved, of God. See, as followers of Jesus, we need to be the healers. As followers of Jesus, we need to be the reconcilers. And instead, we so often, due to our fears of the unknown, we place walls in our hearts. And these walls can act as barriers between people, between us and other countries, between us and other religions, between us and different races. And we've all been guilty of that. And I wonder if you could ask yourself this morning, who have I set up a wall for in my life? Who have I set up a wall for? Because in thinking about our commandment, thou shalt not kill, we have set up walls that do not assist in flourishing, but they help in keeping people out. These walls are keeping people then at a distance, and that does not add to their life. Distance from people does also not let us off the hook. See, the idea of trying to be neutral sounds good in theory, but ask the person to whom you are not taking a side. Ask the person who you are choosing to not build a relationship with. Ask how it feels for them. See, keeping people out leads to the diminishment of their life. And if I have learned anything specifically in the last 3 years as being a part of Grace Point, trying to play it safe, trying to not take either side hurts others in the process. And it does not keep you safe from the hard things that you are called to do. For example, when you hear someone put down another person, when they're making a poor joke that is sexist or racist, when you see someone put something on social media, most of us assume that we have three options, right? One, we can get involved. We can stand up for what is right, stand up for the one who is being hurt here. Two, we can just willfully ignore it because it's not our fight to fight and that will keep us out of it. Or three, we can laugh with them. We can join in with them. We can continue the mocking because it's all just fun and games, right? Well, I want to clarify here, what I have learned is there's actually only two options. There is the first option to stand up for what is right in some form or fashion, which then aids in human flourishing. Or two, choosing to do nothing or choosing to join in the joke are both actually diminishing life. So when we start to build walls, those walls between us and whoever our them is, we think that we are protecting ourselves, and yet we are choosing to not add to flourishing even in the smallest of ways. And I believe that we have a daily responsibility, whether we want to recognize it or not, to live out this call to be life givers, to be able to walk with people in love and to speak in love. So I wonder, instead of choosing to build those walls, if we are hesitant of some other people, can we choose to place windows instead, theoretically, so we can start listening and start paying attention and seeing people, gazing into their lives, and then eventually, hopefully, we'll build bridges that lead to and from them safely. See, in our separation from each other, we've divided the world by our preferences, or sometimes even far worse, by our prejudices. We tend as humans to generalize. I do it, you do it. We generalize about genders, about cultures, about religions, about societies. We end up taking something very specific and then applying it much more broadly, right? So if we say things like, all dogs chase squirrels, when I have two dogs and one of my dogs could care less, right? Or we say things like, all little girls play with dolls, when in fact that's not true. We take one or few facts and we make broader, more universal statements. See, generalizations, though, can be just like stereotypes, and that they're sometimes wrong and very harmful. They can add to the diminishing of someone's life. See, we're all so unique here. We're all on our own beautiful journeys. And usually it's best for us to stick with specifics with people instead of generalizations. And that is exactly what Jesus did all the time. Also, sometimes we use our imaginations to actually try and manage our God. We try our hardest to confine God in that same us versus them mentality. I love this quote by Anne Lamott, and she says, "You can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people that you do." One way I think we've been adding to the diminishment of others is when we as Christians, we have in the past declared boldly that our God is greater, our God is higher, our God is better. And that is actually playground talk for our God will beat up your God, okay?
And then we try to imagine Jesus actually posturing himself in any of those ways. And you begin to see how foolish we've been, how complicit we've been in choosing to cause pain with our words, sometimes with our songs and with our actions. That the God we've imagined in our prayers, in our words, in our songs is exactly opposite of the God that we were shown in Jesus. Jesus doesn't live by the sword. Jesus lived with a towel ready to wash some people's feet, willing to serve. Jesus was a healer of life. He gave birth to new life. He did not aid in the ending of people's lives. He said in John, "I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly." Jesus welcomed any and all to a table to share in his life. And Jesus is who we not only believe in, but who we must follow. Who we must follow. Many say that the sole purpose of religion is to be a servant to the world. And others say that a religion is best judged by its benefits to its non-members. How are you treating your they? So I say again, yes, thou shalt not murder in any form. We cannot cause human suffering. We cannot aid in the diminishment of life. We cannot use our words to harm in any setting. This summer, on June 17th, we were all in shock when we heard the news about a young man who walked into the Emmanuel African Episcopal Church, who sat with them through a Bible study and a prayer time, and then proceeded to shoot and kill 9 human beings. We were shocked. How dare he? Thou shalt not kill. But then, to take it a step further, I say to us, do we also refuse to see the racist systems and societies who continue to load that gun? Thou shalt not kill. That is on us. And so today, am I a life giver or am I a life taker? When you walk into a room, do you say, "Here I am"? Or do you walk into a room and say, "There you are"? Do you see other people? Are you using your life to broadly recognize the ways in which our society, our country, even the Christian church in the past have made mistakes that have withheld life? The ways that we've made mistakes that have withheld honor or privileges from certain people. And then are we choosing to intentionally say today, I will no longer use whatever voice I have or platform or position or influence. I will use that for good. One of our congregants has an autoimmune disease, and she weekly or biweekly goes and receives these blood transfusions, and she always feels amazing afterwards. She can just take on life, ready to tackle the world. And I was thinking, can I be like that with people? When people leave a conversation or a time with me, do they leave encouraged and uplifted, or do they feel drained? See, we have these two options, and the goal of righteousness, the goal of living a whole and healthy life as the beloved children of God, is not only to avoid the negative. It is not just thou shalt not kill, but it is also, am I creating opportunity for an abundant life for others as well? It is both. A little over 9 years ago now, goodness, before I had my son Hutch, I have 2 children. Haven is hiding in the back, quietly holding her phone. Really good churchgoer. So I also have a 9-year-old son named Hutch. He's back at home with daddy. But before I had Hutch, I was in the best shape of my life, right? This happens before you have kids. And I took boxing and I loved it. I loved the excitement in the rings. I loved hitting the pads. I loved learning how to react quickly and effectively to be able to take someone else out. I loved the fight. And so last year, we were moving out of our home and into a new home, and I found these old boxing gloves that were hidden in the back of my closet. And I decided it was time to throw them out for a lot of reasons. One, I have a back injury, and I can't do those fun things anymore. But also, I realized I am drawn too often into the fight of life. See, I'm an 8 on the Enneagram. Are you familiar with the Enneagram? Anybody? Nobody. Okay, so the Enneagram, it's sort of like a personality test. There's 9 numbers, and everyone qualifies into one number. And no number's better than the others, but every number has its strengths and its weaknesses. And so my number, an 8, is known as the challenger. I have been known to be that person that asks, is this a private fight or can I join in? I'm that, okay? I just love it. So I've loved the confrontation in the arena of the everyday, of the in-person, of online, on social media. And we all know, if any of you are you on Facebook, any of you? Yes. Okay, so we recognize that social media has been a training ground for people for quick and reactive comebacks to get the most bang for our 140 characters, right? We see it happen every day, and I've been just as guilty as the next person. And as I stared at those boxing gloves as we were moving, I knew that it was time to let go. I knew that it was time to stop fighting, that this was something that I needed to outgrow as well, because I don't want to fight anymore. It's not accomplishing anything. Sure, it feels good in the moment to fight back, to react, to one-up someone, throw a little scripture here, a little doctrine there, a critique here, but that isn't who we are. That isn't actually who we were called to be. This hopeful, peacemaking nature that I'm creating in is beginning to finally mature and make itself out 36 years later. See, our lives can be a better defense than just our words. There are new ways that you and I can train then for this approach to life, to the abundant life. Ways that we can willingly not be so defensive with people. Ways that we can constantly try and gain a broader perspective. See, when something is in perspective, it's considered as a part of a more complete situation. You have a fair and accurate understanding of it. Are you familiar with this quote that says, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." There's a broader perspective that you and I can gain. And I want to remind you today that we are talking ultimately about living a life that aids in human flourishing. And so there is nothing then life-giving in choosing to be in the fight. There is hurt. There is shutting an opponent down or knocking them out. There is nothing that is life-giving. And I believe that we as Christians, as followers of Jesus, and today is our reminder to all of us that we are to be in the life business, the resurrection and reconciliation movement. The restoration of all things is the heartbeat of the kingdom that we pledge our allegiance to. It's not the kingdoms and systems of this world. We know, and we've seen again today, that the opposite of life is death. The opposite of reconciliation then is to tear down or to break apart. The opposite of healing is to make sick. The opposite of that restoration then is to damage or destroy. See, I look, I read, I hear so many things come out of my mouth, though, that choose to follow the latter ideas. And we need to ask ourselves again and again, am I bringing about life in this situation? Am I choosing to savor or restore life in each situation? We also, and I need this maybe more than everybody, we need to be able to back up from our attachment to these phones, our attachment to the online world of Facebook and all these things, and we need to be involved better in real life. I need to be involved in my children's lives and get off my phone when we're on the couch or at home. Or at the very least, I need to remember that behind those Facebook profiles, when I want to choose to have a comeback, that those are real people in hurting situations. And I hope that the same would be applied to me. I've always loved this quote from Madeline L'Engle that says, "I have a point of view. You have a point of view. God has view." Oh, God has view. Now hear me, your opinion, it still can be of worth and value by realizing humbly that it is yours and it is just one opinion. So can we hold it? Yes. Can we speak it? Yes. Can we share it? Yes. But we must offer it with humility and with grace. Now hear me saying, I am not suggesting that you and I should throw in the towel of surrender. No. That's a declaration of giving in. And we are not giving up. But we as followers of Christ, we are just laying the gloves down and we're choosing to step out of the ring. We will run this race. We will finish the fight, but it will be the good fight that Timothy speaks of, or in 2 Timothy. The good fight, though, is not with people. It is not against denominations. It's not liberals versus conservatives or fundamentalists. It's not against religions. It's not against Muslims or Hindus. It's not with people of a different color than you. It is not against the LGBT community. The fight is not against rich or poor. The good fight is fought against the ways of this world that are stated, that stand against what the kingdom of God, the beloved community, stands for. The good fight is against that. It's against the systems of evil that murder and oppress, that tear down, that try to diminish life. The systems that steal worth and lock us in cages of false certainty and pride. The good fight, if fought well, ends with restoration. It will make all things new. It does not slam doors. It does not lock people in or out. It is motivated by love and compassion, and it drops keys. It liberates people, as the poet Hafiz so beautifully wrote. This is the fight that we are to believe in. We need to back away from that closed fighting ring where winner takes all, and we move out then into the open pasture where freedom reigns and there is space at the table for all people. See, we are in this beautiful world together. Now, we can and should come back to that fighting ring, but not to engage in the fight, but to look for those people who need to know what liberation looks like and invite them back to the table. Thou shalt not murder. May we live by that rule in all ways, with our lives, with our words, and with our actions. May they be ones not of lashing out, but of covering. May our lives be ones of protecting and of bearing burdens. And let's drop as many keys to the abundant life as we can. Love will be our training ground. And as a Christians, we've shouted things like they will know us by our love. And yet sometimes we also bring our rule book and our whiteboard so that we can begin to mark what they're getting wrong and what we're getting right. We've all been guilty of gossip or of speaking down to someone, of holding anger or resentment in our heart. So I ask you and I ask myself, instead of bringing that rule book and check marks, what we need to carry is that towel. We need to be ready to wash some tired and dirty feet. We need to be able to build a larger table, broader than all of us could ever imagine, a table of welcome and of honor for whomever comes our way, and turn those people, whoever our other is, whoever they is, let's turn them into guests of honor. See, I believe that we should take notice of the smallness of Jesus, the humility of Christ, and know that in huge part, that is what our image of God, that we know God best by, and then it's our call to mirror that in our lives. Jesus was so alive to the reality of God, so transparent to the love of God, so at one with the life of God, that we Christians assert that God was his very meaning. See, with Jesus, all of human bitterness, rivalry, jealousy, envy, human hostility, it is transformed in Jesus into a life-giving power that accepts abuse. It endures pain. It allows death, and it gives only love in return. That is what Jesus lived out. He was the new humanity, the new being, the full response to the covenant that we were giving. And as such, he is the human face of our invisible God. In Jesus's life, the final and deepest meaning of the sixth commandment is seen, for you cannot give life by killing. John Shelby Spong says, look at the victim dead upon the cross, who nonetheless is strangely alive and life-giving. And then observe the victors who gaze upon his lifeless body and do not seem to recognize that they are the ones who are dead. Here we discover the depths of the biblical truth, namely that it is not enough to obey the letter of the law, but to feel the spirit of the law's intention. For that spirit finally calls us to live life and then to share life without ever stopping to count the cost. Another one of my favorite books is by a man named Samir Salmanovic. It's called It's Really All About God. And he says, I've come to think of God's perceived absence in this world as a sign of God's faith in us. Yes, God believes in us. So we need to recognize the power and the responsibility that we have. So let us move forward, being aware of all the ways that our words can wound or heal. Let us move forward today, being aware of the actions that either are keeping people in or choosing to push people out. Let us not be a people who conspire in our own diminishment or that of others. And as much as we are assured again to follow that command, thou shalt not murder, in all of its implications, let us also in turn intentionally add to the life of people and to our world. May the beloved community, the kingdom of God, continue to come on earth as it is in heaven, and may it be furthered by my life and by yours as co-creators in this beautiful world with God. Again, in James 3, it said, with our tongues, we bless God our Father, but with that same tongue, we curse the very men and women who are made in his image. Curses and blessings come out of the same mouth. And so I'm going to close my part this morning, not with the commandment of what we shouldn't do, but with the blessing of maybe what we should do. I wrote this small prayer and this small blessing back in 2012, the day that Obama was first voted into office. There was a lot of craziness and fighting, obviously, online and in our country. And I wrote these words then, but I believe they are still applicable to us today. So let me pray this blessing over us. May we be the blessing today and not the curse. May we encourage one another towards an abundant life. May we seek peace and reconciliation in our own hearts and with the hearts of those around us. May we live humbly. May we see our enemy first as brother, as sister, as mother, or as father. May we give all people, our family, our friends, our neighbors, our communities, and our leaders, the benefit of the doubt. May we let love lead us. May we let generosity guide our actions. May we stand for what Christ stood for, or rather, stand with those whom Christ stands with, all people. May we get down off our fences and our high posts and come down into the level ground, into the open space where all truly live. May we dwell in this fertile ground where our lives will eventually turn outward and turn towards others. May we allow our focus to turn from me to them, to you, and finally to us. May we live united. May we seek shalom. May we be reminded that the image of God is in all of our lives. This morning and moving forward, may we be the blessing and not the curse. Do you say amen? Amen. Thank you.
Can you guys thank Melissa Green? I had never heard a sermon on that command either, and I'm so glad I didn't give it. Wasn't that fantastic? Wasn't that amazing? Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, Melissa. That was so moving, so powerful. A couple things before we send you out. Melissa, you mind hanging around, let people come up and say hi to you? Yeah, so Melissa will be around. Please come up and welcome her and thank her for those words. My goodness. I'm not really a shouter, but there were a couple times when I was on the fence. A couple things before we send you out. We are in the process of elder selection and nomination. And so we have two elder vacancies that will be coming up. So if you know of a person that you think would be a good fit, and basically what we mean by that is somebody who is committed to our community, somebody who's involved, somebody who loves our church, somebody who shares our mission and our vision, somebody who is about the next step on the journey, we would love for you to nominate them. And so there are nomination forms out there. We also need people to be nominated for our elder selection team. As a congregation, you have three representatives, and it is up to you to choose who those three people are. So all those forms are out at the Connection Point. We would love for you to be a part of that. There's one other thing at the Connection Point you need to know about, and that is next Sunday afternoon, we're having our fall festival at 4 p.m., and there are things you can sign up for. There are trunks of treats. Decorate your trunk so kids can come by. There is a cake walk where we, send the kids home with all sorts of sweet things and let their parents deal with the consequences. And then there's the most important thing, which is the pumpkin pie contest, which I get to judge every year. Me and Tommy, that's our calling in life, I think, is to eat pumpkin pie that's really good. And so nobody has signed up for that yet. So please go out and sign it. Let me preface this. If you actually can make pumpkin pie well, go out and sign up for and I've said this every year, but there was this one year where there was a really weird pie that tasted like beef. We don't want the beef pie. We want good pumpkin pie. So if you can make a good pumpkin pie, please go ahead and sign up for that as well. And let's make next Sunday evening a great evening for our kids. And it's not only for our kids. We usually have lots of people who aren't part of our church who bring their kids by, dress them up, and we get to give them free candy and love on them for a bit. So it's a really, really good opportunity to just show the love of Jesus, which we've been talking about this morning, and to aid life and flourishing. So please be a part of that. Let's stand together, and we'll send you out in the world to go practice what Melissa preached.